Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 31. I'm going to do verses 1 through 54. Long chapter, but it won't be an extraordinarily long video. Vengeance on Midian is our topic for today. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Numbers 30, verses 1 through 16, we talked about how men and women were to take vows and when women could disavow their vows when they wanted the protection of their either their father or their husband. So now we start in Numbers 31, verses 1 through 5. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward you will be gathered to your people." Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war." So they were furnished from the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Now who are these Midianites who are getting ready to feel the full brunt of God's punishment? They were the tribe that had allied themselves with the Moabites. Now remember, Israel is now in the land of the Moabites, which is right across the Jordan River to the east, right to the north of the Dead Sea, in that area, the plains of Moab. We read in Numbers 25, 16 through 18 so that we can see how the Midianites are connected to the Moabites. And as we're going to see here, the Moabites are not destined for destruction and not destined for judgment, for military judgment as the Midianites are. But we'll see their connection here in a couple of verses. Numbers 25, 16 through 18 first. The Lord told Moses, "Attack the Midianites and strike them dead, for they attacked you with the treachery that they used against you in the Peor incident." They did the same in the case involving their sister Cosby, daughter of the Midianite leader who was killed the day the plague came at Peor. Now, Cosby was the Midianite princess who had religious sex with the Israelite prince Zimri. And so we see that Cosby was a Midianite. Now, the Midianites were said here in Numbers 25 to have fought against Israel or hurt Israel in the Peor incident. Now, we'll use that Peor incident to tie the Midianites to the Moabites because the Moabites are tied to the Peor incident in Numbers 25, verses 1 through 3. While Israel was staying in the acacia grove, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. Moab, now not Midian, but these are the women of Moab. The women invited them to the sacrifices for their gods, and the people ate and bowed and worshipped to their gods. So Israel aligned itself with Baal of Peor. So there you have the Baal of Peor being worshipped by the women of Moab in Numbers 25, and then the Peor incident was said to have been led into by the Midianite women in Numbers 25, 16 through 18. So the Midianite women and the Moab women were equally bad. Now these Midianites had also allied themselves with the obnoxious Amorites. Those were the tribes, Sihon of the Amorite and Og of Bashan. Sihon had attacked the Moabite territory that went up basically from the Arnon River up to the Jabbok or somewhere to the north of the Dead Sea, somewhere up there. I'm not sure exactly where. And then Og of Bashan had come down from the east of the Sea of Galilee on down to the Jabbok River, which is halfway down the Jordan River heading to the Dead Sea. So in that area, east of the Transjordan area, the Amorites had taken over briefly before the Israelites came, but then the Israelites wiped out those Amorites, Sihon and Og. And so now we're back dealing with the natives of the land, the Moabites. But we see that in Joshua 13:21, the Midianites also had allied themselves with the Amorites, not only with the Moabites, who were indigenous there, they were there first, but also with the conquering Amorites. The Midianites had allied themselves with both. Let's read Joshua 13:21. "Even all the cities of the plain and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon." Heshbon is right there in the plains of Moab, at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, to the east of the Dead Sea. "The Amorites that reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses struck with the chiefs of Midian." So Moses beat the Amorites. As we know, Sihon was wiped out by Israel, as I've already said. But also here in Joshua 13:21, we see that along with the Amorites, Moses struck the chiefs of Midian. They're named here Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hor, and Reba, the princes of Sihon who lived in the land. So the Midianite kings, or kinglets, if you will, five of them, were called the princes of Sihon. They were his kept men. They were his boys, Sihon the Amorite. So the Midianites are allied with the Amorites. They're allied with the Moabites. Some bad people. Now a question will arise here. we see why the Midianites are listed for judgment, but why are the Moabites not mentioned for judgment? We're going to give you four possible options to answer that question. Here's option number one, because Lot was the ancestor of the Moabites, and because Lot was a member of the chosen race, the Jews, God wanted to let the Moabites off here. This is suggested by Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Not that they agree with it, but they mention this theory. We read in Deuteronomy 2:9, a verse to support this idea. Then the Lord said to me, Do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. Ar is the capital of Moab. I've given Moab to the sons of Lot as a possession. So God's promised Moab to Lot, and by golly, we're not going to punish Moab for what they did. Problem with that nice little theory is John Gill points out, well, the Midianites were the offspring of Abraham by Keturah. Keturah was Abraham's wife after Sarah. So why weren't the Midianites spared? Because of their illustrious ancestry. They weren't. They were clobbered in military with a military defeat just because Abraham was their ancestor. That didn't save them. So why should the Moabites be saved? Because Lot was their ancestor. So I don't think that's a good theory. The Lot theory, I'll call it, as to why the Moabites are not mentioned here. Here's theory number two. Gill suggests this because Ruth was descended from the Moabites. We know Ruth. We all love Ruth. And by golly, we're not going to hurt the ancestors of Ruth by making them be punished here. Well, I don't think so. I don't think that's a good theory. John Gill says the Moabites were not mentioned here because they were reserved for later punishment. They do get wiped out eventually. I forgot the details of it. Probably by the Babylonians in 586 BC when they came in and wiped out everybody in the area. But anyway, they are not mentioned here just because God didn't mention them because their time hadn't gotten there yet. Maybe so. Here's a good theory. This is my favorite theory as to why the Moabites are not mentioned here. It's because the Midianites were the principal actors in this crime of seduction. The Moabites were mere accessories as they seduced the Israelites, as the Midianites and Moabites together seduced the Israelites to idolatry. The Moabites were just accessories, and accessories are not punished nearly as much as the principal actors are. But I would point out to you, accessories are punished even in law. Well, here's what John Gill says about that. Quote, the Midianites, who seem to have advised Balak at first to send for Balaam to curse Israel, and who harbored that soothsayer after he had been dismissed by Balak. Well, now that's an idea here, because Moab refused to, they wanted to, but they didn't get Balaam to curse Israel, whereas when Balaam left Moab, the Midianites took Balaam, that false prophet, took him in, and then Balaam, as we'll see later, gave the advice to seduce the Israelites, and so the Midianites were, according to this theory, more to blame. Well, I think all this is speculation. I don't know why the Moabites were not mentioned. It doesn't matter. They got theirs later on anyway. The Midianites are particularly mentioned, though. And Moses got to see all this before he died, or before he was gathered to his ancestors. That phrase, gathered to his forefathers, is a euphemism for die. Now, that euphemism strongly implies a conscious existence in another world, as Adam Clark says, because if you're gathered to your forefathers, that means they're still there, living in another world beyond this one. Now, Moses got a consolation prize here. He got to see Israel's enemies wiped out right before he died. I guess that made him feel good, especially if you can stomach all the blood and the guts. Now, this war is the Lord's war, Yahweh's war. Moses says, go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. That's Yahweh's vengeance, not Moses. This was not a petty act of Moses' vengeance, as the NIV Study Bible says. Why was it a holy war as opposed to a war of personal revenge? Well, because the Midianites seduced the Israelites to sexual immorality, bad enough, but even worse than that, the Midianites seduced the Israelites to worship the Baal of Peor. So you got sexual immorality, physical adultery, and you've also got spiritual adultery. This was a war for justice, a war for judgment of sin, and that is not a petty act of revenge. Now, 1,000 troops were picked from each tribe. And the reason for this, according to the NIV Study Bible, is that the burden for the holy war was to be shared equally. I have a question here, though. Is the NIV Study Bible really right when they say that the burden was shared equally? You got tribes of different sizes. So that means a small tribe, if they have to produce 1,000 soldiers, that means the burden on them is more difficult or more heavy or heavier than the burden on a large tribe who has to provide 1,000 soldiers. Well, the answer to that is, A smaller tribe might have a heavier burden when their soldiers are provided, but those soldiers got more booty, the people of the smaller tribe got more booty because there was less people to share their proportionate share of the booty. So I guess it's still pretty fair. Making each tribe participate would obviate jealousy and strife. Everybody gets to participate equally. The burdens might not be exactly equal, but the profits might not be exactly equal either, but it would be obviously fair to everybody participating. Now, 12,000 soldiers is not very many soldiers to fight against a large nation, as John Gill says. And remember, they had over 600,000 who could have fought. The original census was 603,000. I think we've already got past the second census, which was slightly under that. Over 600,000 people that could have fought. Why did God only choose 12,000? Well, John Gill speculates it was to show that it was to be the Lord who got the victory, not man. And this would encourage Israelites for the battles ahead. They say, hey, we just took 12,000 soldiers, wiped out the Midianites. Well, with 600,000 soldiers, maybe we can wipe out the Canaanites when we get to the promised land. Now, these 12,000 soldiers, John Gill says it appears that Levi was included. Now, I don't believe Gill is right here. Levi is often omitted in census list. He's not mentioned here. Why does Gill think Levi was included? Well, here are a listing of the 12 tribes which does not include Levi. Ephraim 1, Ephraim 2, Manasseh 3, Dan 4, Naphtali 5, Gad 6, Asher 7, Manasseh 8, Simeon 9, Judah 10, Benjamin 11, Zebulun and 12, Reuben. There you go. There's your 12 tribes. How did I do it? Well, you take Levi out of the list of 12. That leaves you 11 tribes. Now take Joseph out. He was one of the patriarchs, the brother of all those other guys I just mentioned. So you take Joseph out. Now you got 10 tribes. But now Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Add them back in. You got 12 tribes. So every tribe provided 1,000 soldiers for war, but not the tribe of Levi. Those were the religious guys. They took care of the religious ritual, the Levitical ritual. They didn't go fight in the army. I don't know where Gil got that idea from. We go to Numbers 31, verse 6. Moses sent them, 1,000 from each tribe, to the war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, to the war with them, and the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. Now, Phinehas is the famous Phinehas who stuck Cosri, the Moabite princess, and Zimri, the Israelite prince. He stabbed them in their tent as they were getting it on. Or at least that's the implication from the text as we read this. Numbers 25:8, and he, referring to Phinehas, went after the man of Israel, that's Zimri, into the tent and pierced both of them, Zimri and Cosby, pierced them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Now, it doesn't say they were actually having sex when they were pierced by Phinehas, but let's face it, that makes the story so much better, doesn't it? Phinehas went into that tent and speared them like a shish kebab. Now, Phinehas is sent into the war with the 12,000 troops. It doesn't say that Phinehas was the actual leader of the 12,000. Many people say he did lead this war with Midian because he had taken the lead in chapter 25 when he stabbed Zimri and Cosby, and he is mentioned here, so I think that's a reasonable assumption, especially since no mention is made of Moses or Joshua. Those would have been two military leaders that could have led this excursion, but they aren't mentioned, so I think Phinehas was probably the leader of the expedition, but John Gill doubts that. He said every tribe has its military leader, and his argument is when we get down to verse 14, Moses was angry with the army for not killing the women. And as he was expressing his anger with the army, he didn't mention Phinehas at all. He mentioned all the officers together. Well, maybe so, but Phinehas was mentioned right here in verse 6. Reverend Gill, Phinehas, the sons of Eleazar the priest, is mentioned. So I think he was probably leading. Clark doesn't think so. He says Phinehas was a priest. The priest was going to accompany the ark. He's not going to lead the battle. Here's Clark's take on this weighty subject. Quote, some think he was made general in this expedition, but this is not likely. The ark and its contents must proceed to this battle because the battle was the Lord's, and he dwelt between the cherubim over the ark. And Phinehas, who had before got a grant in the eternal priesthood, was chosen to accompany the ark in place of his father Eleazar, who was probably now too far advanced in years to undergo the fatigue. So that's Clark's speculation, that Phinehas was not leading the military, but was carrying the ark. Clark says it was Joshua that led the battle. Now, of course, Joshua was a well-known military leader. He beat the Amalekites right before the Israelites got to Mount Sinai. And, of course, he's going to lead the Israelites across the Jordan River. So, yeah, he's the big general, but why is he not mentioned here? That's a problem. By saying Joshua led the battle against the Midianites, Adam Clark says, because it was a holy war and God's going to get all the glory. Well, no, I don't think so. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, although it is not expressly mentioned, it is highly probable that Joshua was the general who conducted this war. The presence of the priest, who was always with the army, was necessary to preside over the Levites, who accompanied the expedition, and to inflame the courage of the combatants by his sacred services and counsel. Now, actually, that makes sense, because I've been making a big deal out of the fact that Phinehas is mentioned here. Moses sent them 1,000 from each tribe to the war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest. He could have been mentioned not because he was the leader of the soldiers, but because he was carrying the ark. All right, so we'll give some credence to the idea that Joshua led the battle and not Phinehas, even though I just said I thought it was Phinehas. Upon further reflection, maybe not. How do we know that the priest is supposed to go forth and battle with the Israelites? We read in Deuteronomy 20, verse 2, when you are about to engage in battle, the priest is to come forward and address the army, get them all charged up. Now, Phinehas goes to the war and the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. So Phinehas had holy vessels and trumpets. Now, this is a little confusing. It does kind of support the idea that Phinehas was leading as a religious leader, not a military leader. It says he has holy vessels. What does that mean? Why would you take holy vessels to the war? Well, in speaking generically of these holy vessels, this shows that it was a holy war. Now, what were these holy vessels? John Gill has some speculations. He said it could be the ark that the priest carried. It could be the ark plus the plate of gold on the high priest's forehead. It could be the ephod, the breastplate on the ephod, and the Urim and Thummim in the breastplate. The Urim and Thummim, probably white rocks, black. Nobody knows what they are, so I like to say there's a white rock and black rock in there. You pick white for yes and black for no. But at any rate, these were well-known instruments of the religious cultus, if you will, of the Israelites. And so Gill suggests they would be carried. But I haven't quite, why would you carry that to a war? I don't think so. I think they stayed right there, either on the high priest. Well, now, Eleazar didn't go. He wasn't the high priest. If Phinehas went, he was not the high priest, so he wouldn't be having the high priest garments on him. So I think this is far-fetched. I don't think that's what it's talking about. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown says the holy vessels are the trumpets, citing Numbers 10:9, when you go to war in your land against the adversary who attacks you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before the Lord your God and be saved from your enemies. Now that makes sense, because they're about to go out to war, and blowing trumpets was a common thing they did when they mustered for war. And so, but we would have to read the verse this way. Moses sent them 1,000 from each tribe to the war, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest to the war with them, and the holy vessels, even the trumpets for the alarm in his hands. And the holy vessels, not and the holy vessels and the trumpets, but and the holy vessels, even the trumpets for the alarm, which would make trumpets be in apposition with holy vessels. So the trumpets were the holy vessels that were carried into the war, because we need to blow the trumpets. Well, for military signals, for retreat, for victory, all kinds of good stuff, for mustering. So in my humble opinion, that's what the holy vessels were the trumpets that were blown. So Phinehas, as a substitute for Eleazar, who's the current high priest, Phinehas carries the trumpets into war. We now go to Numbers 31, verses 7 through 10. So they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian along with the rest of their slain, Evi and Rekem and Zur and Hur and Reba, or Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones, and all their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods they plundered. Then they burned all their cities where they lived and all their camps with fire. Now this was a blowout victory. Verse 7, they made war against Midian just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So this is not Moses' idea. This is God's idea to wipe out the Midianites, or not to, I say wipe out. That sounds like everyone were exterminated. We'll see in a minute. They all were not exterminated, but they were beaten, thrashed pretty badly. It says they killed every male. That cannot mean every male Midianite. It means every male they could get their hands on. As John Gill says, quote, every male, quote, which fell into their hands, for no doubt there were multitudes that made their escape, since in later times we read of the Midianites as a very powerful people and very distressing to Israel in Judges 6:1. So every male that was captured is killed. That's an adult male. It does not include the children. We read in verse 9 about the little ones. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones. So they were little, the children, the little boys and girls were not killed. And the women were not killed. And not every single male was killed, but the males that were captured were killed. Now these kings of Midian that were killed, Evi, Rikam, Zur, Hur, and Ariba, they were also called, as I mentioned earlier, the princes of Sihon. Moses in Joshua 13:21, Moses is struck with the chiefs of Midian, the Amorites, whom Moses is struck with the chiefs of Midian, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba, the princes of Sihon. So these princes of Moab were subordinate to Sihon before Moses wiped out Sihon, before the Israelites just wiped out Sihon. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say probably at one time these five princes of Midian had been subject to Sihon, that Amorite ruler. One of these five princes of Sihon is named Zur in verse 8. He's probably the father of Cosby. Cosby, of course, is the Midianite woman who had sex with Zimri and who got speared by Phinehas in the tent while they were having sex. Numbers 25:15, the name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cosby, the daughter of Zur. It's probably the same Zur. Now, an interesting point here is in verse 8, amongst the slain in this Midianite war was Balaam, the son of Beor. That's the famous Balaam prophet who was called down from Syria, Pethor, I think his city was, right south of Carchemish on the Euphrates River. He had been called down to curse by the king of Moab, Balak, to curse Israel. And of course, he wanted to do it. He wanted to make the money, but God kept telling him, don't you do that. You can go down there and prophesy, but you're not going to curse my people. And you remember Balaam had his little encounter with that talking donkey that the angel of the Lord, Jesus, probably put the words in the donkey's mouth to make Balaam look like an ass. So, an ass like his ass he was riding. That's the same Balaam here. He's dead. Now, Balaam, as we'll see here in verse 16 in just a minute, Balaam was one who gave explicit advice to the Midianites women to seduce the Israelites. Numbers 31:16 says this, yet they, referring to the Midianite women, are the ones who, at Balaam's advice, incited the Israelites to unfaithfulness against the Lord in the Peor incident, so that the plague came against the Lord's community. So the Peor incident, which was having sex with all those Moabite and Midianite women, that came about at Balaam's advice. So, as the NIV Study Bible says, what Balaam could not do through curses, he almost accomplished through seduction. Didn't get away with it, though, and he ended up getting killed. He should have gone back to Pethor. Gone back to Syria without his money. He'd at least had his life, but he didn't do that. He apparently diverged from going home as first intended. Numbers 24:25 says this, then Balaam arose and departed, that means departed from the Moabites, and returned to his place. And Balak also went his way. Well, he was going to his place, but then the Midianites talked him into staying, and Balaam says, well, why don't you seduce him? All right, so the Midianites' goods and cattle and flocks and so forth were plundered, and then all their city was burned. And John Gill says that means all the cities as far as the Israelites had advanced. That did not necessarily include the whole land of Midian, which was Midianites are spread all over the place. If you recall, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, and also known as Reuel, and Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, were Midianites. And, of course, Moses married Zipporah. So this means all of the cities that were involved in this war with the Midianites got burnt down. You got to be careful with that word all. You take it too extensively and you create distortions in your interpretation. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about that all the cities phrase, quote, but the destruction appears to have been only partial, limited to those who were in the neighborhood of the Hebrew camp and who had been accomplices in the villainous plot of Baal Peor. While a large portion of the Midianites were absent on their pastoral wanderings or had saved themselves by flight. And we'll see, of course, that the Midianites are still around. Judges 6:1, the famous story of Gideon. The Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord handed them over to Midian seven years. Gideon was fighting the Midianites, so they're still around in the time of the Judges, the time of Gideon. So it wasn't like they destroyed them from the face of the earth, but they wiped them out locally in that battle. Did a number on them, the Israelites did. We go down to Numbers 31, verses 11 and 12. They, that's the Israelites, took all the spoil and all the prey, both of man and of beast. They brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the congregation of the sons of Israel to the camp at the plains of Moab, which are by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now when it says all the prey was taken both of man and beast, remember the man part there was only the female portion of man because all the male soldiers had gotten slain. Numbers 31:7, which we just read, says that they waged war against Midian as the Lord had commanded Moses and killed every male. All right, so what it means, both of man and beast, it means both of human beings and beast. Man as opposed to beast, human beings as opposed to beast. Man in the old-fashioned generic sense of human. Of course, now in our feminist besotted age, we can't say man anymore. That might sound to somebody like toxic masculinity, and we've got to get rid of all gender references in our language because there's no such thing as gender. Did God create mankind, male and female? Well, we're not going to have any of that, no sir, because we are independent humanists and we don't need God anymore and we don't need his gender creation. To heck with that. But anyway, both of man and beast means both human beings as opposed to beast. One geographical note here in verse 12, all of this where Moses is dealing with dividing up the spoil was at the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now, that's an interesting phrase. It could just be by the Jordan River, which is opposite Jericho, because if you look at the map, they're right there at the northern end of the Dead Sea. Jericho is just a little bit northeast of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is right at the top end, the northern end of the Dead Sea, on the west side of the Jordan River. So that could be what it means. It's just talking about the Jordan River, which is opposite Jericho. But that phrase, Jordan opposite Jericho, according to the end of a note, says the Hebrew is the Jordan of Jericho, which is possibly an ancient name for the Jordan River. Well, that would be what I just said, the Jordan of Jericho. Or it could be they're in some land opposite Jericho, which is by the Jordan. It doesn't matter. They're in the plains of Moab. We go down to Numbers 31, verses 13 through 18. Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the leaders of the congregation went out to meet them outside the camp. Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds who had come from service in the war. And Moses said to them, "Have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known man intimately. But all the girls who have not known man intimately, spare for yourselves." All right, Moses is ticked off. The army didn't do what he wanted to do. And Moses gets real tough here. Now, he went out to meet the army outside the camp, along with Eleazar, the high priest, and also the tribal leaders, which I'm going to assume is one tribal leader for every tribe. I might be wrong about that, but that's just a good speculation. So all these guys go outside the camp to see the army. Now, why did he go out to meet the army? He could have gone out to honor the troops. As John Gill suggests, he might have gone out to stop them from coming into the camp until they were purified. We'll see the purification in just a minute. Gill and Jameson Foster Brown suggest that. Or he could have been going out to see if the Lord's commands had been executed properly. Maybe the commands had been given by Moses to the army, and those commands had not been fully recorded in our text here. But at any rate, the army didn't do what Moses wanted to be done. Now, I've mentioned this already. Verse 14 says Moses was angry with the officers. He didn't mention Joshua by name. You know, maybe Moses was trying to cover up, didn't want to make Joshua look bad here. So he just says officers. Who knows? Now, he wants to know why the women, first of all, the women were spared. Now, this was not a rhetorical question asked for information. He knew that the women were spared. He was ticked off. He wanted the women killed. They were the ones that did the seduction. Now, I'm going to make a statement in defense of the officers. In the normal practice of war back then, you didn't kill the women. You preserved the women captives for slaves. But this was a holy war. This was a serious war. So Moses says, you shouldn't have done that. And then he mentions Moses did. He said, hey, these women seduced Israel, and Israel died of the plague. The plague was among the congregation because of these women, he says in verse 16. Numbers 25:9 says that those who died by the plague were 24,000 Israelites. These women killed 24,000 men. Well, first of all, was it really their? Well, I guess it was their fault. You know, you seduce somebody to crime, you entice somebody to crime, you're guilty. But we need to remember, if the Israelites were guilty too, the ones that went in and had sex with those women, they were just as guilty. But at any rate, Moses wants the women killed. Now, of course, that raises an apologetic problem. Oh, how can a loving God kill women? Now, you know, I have a problem with this because my Southern culture says put women up on a pedestal, you know, the old chivalry thing, and you sit on the back of a horse with a rose in your right hand and a book of poetry in your left hand, and you read poems to the damsel who you're not going to marry because this is chivalry, you know, this is platonic. But at any rate, we treat women, put them on a pedestal, really, treat them nicely, the crown of God's creation, and we don't kill them. Well, that's going to be my attitude, but lately I've watched enough Lifetime movies where the bad villain in the movie is a woman, and oh boy. You know, they say the corruption of the best is the worst, and if women are the part of mankind that is gentle and nourishing and comforting and loving, if that's the best part of mankind, boy, when that gets perverted, women can really be bad, really be bad. And these women were bad. They were bad women. Now, whenever you get to an apologetic problem here, that you can hear the skeptic saying, oh, I don't worship that kind of God. He's not a loving God. It's because people do not take into account the seriousness of sin. That's the answer every time. It's how serious is the sin? God will punish sin. And if you don't like that, when you don't like God, fine. Well, you're going to find out when you end up in hell that God is going to punish your sin. That's just the way it is. Here's what Clark says about this killing of the women. Actually, he's talking about killing the boys, too. I think, have we gotten there yet? The boys were killed. No, we haven't gotten to the boys yet, but the boys were spared, and the women were spared. Okay? For this quote, for this action, I account, Adam Clark says, I account simply on the principle that God, who is the author and supporter of life, has a right to dispose of it when and how he thinks proper, and the judge of all the earth can do nothing but what is right. Well, okay. But still, the reason he did that was because these women were evil. Now, Clark, trying to mitigate the harshness of God, says that the boys and the women went to heaven. Well, now, I'm going to tell you, if that's true, I've got some oceanfront property in Arizona I'd like to sell you. I tell you, these Arminians, they're going to make things nice, aren't they? These women, who Moses just complained had killed 24,000 Israelites with a plague, and who had seduced the Israelite men to idolatrous sex, they went to heaven. Yeah, right, Adam. Please. You're becoming the poster boy for Calvinism just by making such arguments as that. Now, in verse 17, we see that every male is to be killed among the little ones. Remember, the kids were spared so far. The adult males have already been killed, but the little male boys were still alive. Moses said, that's not good enough. They're going to have to die too. So women and children, bam, women and the male children are going to be killed according to Moses. Well, why were they killed and not the girls? The NIV Study Bible speculates that boys could have grown to endanger the inheritance rights of Israelite men. In other words, the men married their newfound Midianite slaves, but they would have previous children to deal with. The little boys, who were the daughters of these Midianite women and the little boys, would inherit in this hurt the inheritance rights of the Israelite men. Well, yeah, to me, that's a stretch. Now, here's Adam Clark's idea. No, the second option is why the boys were killed, not the girls. There's no reason for it, except in God's arbitrary will. Adam Clark says this, quote, for this action, I account simply on the principle that God, who is the author and supporter of life, has a right to dispose of life, when and how he thinks proper, and the judge of all the earth can do nothing but what is right. I just read you that quote. I'll read it again. That's just because God wanted to do it. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate that the boys are killed as well as the men because this was a special war of extermination, like against the Canaanites, and the Midianites equaled the Canaanites in iniquity, so they all got wiped out. Now, here's some speculation by Glenn Miller of the Christian Think Tank. He's one of my favorite apologists. He makes the point that there was no way for Israel to assimilate the boys. Now, if the girls grow up, they're not going to be a member of the army, so they're not going to be a problem. But when the boys grow up, they could be members of military detachments, military forces that would be opposed to Israel, and that would be a problem. And so the idea is these Midianites are so evil, we're going to have to get rid of the boys now so they don't become a problem later. Now, here is a response to those who say that God was cruel to do this, to have the seducing women and the little boys killed as well as the soldiers. First of all, as Glenn Miller says, the boys suffered the results of their parents' decisions. Now, we are very individualistic in Western culture. We say, I don't care what my parents did, I did this. Well, I'm going to tell you something. In the modern world today, there's not a kid alive who's not affected by what their parents do. That's just the way it is, folks. If your mother drinks alcohol and you're in your mother's womb and you get fetal alcohol syndrome, you were born with that, or if they're crack cocaine addicted and you're born as a crack addict, I hate to say it, but you have suffered for something that you didn't do. But your parents did it. So parents and children are much more bound together in the ancient world than they are in our modern individualistic culture. And so that's the way it is. Parents judge, the children are judged with them. Glenn Miller says there's another way to look at this. There was no other option. What are you going to do with these little boys? To mitigate this situation, Israel was attacked. They didn't provoke the attack. The Midianites provoked it. Miller makes the point that no other ancient Near Eastern civilization could assimilate male captives. Except they had one option. They could blind them as slaves so they could never fight again. They had no POW camps. They had nowhere to put them. They didn't want to marry them off to their daughters. There was just nothing they could do with them. And once you let them grow up amongst you, pretty soon they're going to be fighting a war against you. There was no POW camps, I mentioned. There was no social institution like orphanages to send them to. There's nowhere to put them. There was no way to transport them to their kinfolk back in Moses' old stomping ground east of the Gulf of Aqaba and the original Midian down there. And even if you sent them back down there, if you could, you didn't have any way to do it. But if you did, there was no guarantee the southern Midianites would take them in anyway. So they were stuck with these little boys. In fact, in the ancient Near East, killing male captives quickly was considered the most humane way to deal with them. Ooh, it's a rough time. Also, we need to point out that probably only a few boys killed. Those were the ones who had hidden in places like the baggage train. That, of course, is a speculation. We don't know. But at any rate, again, the whole apologetics problem is people do not realize the sinfulness of mankind and the holiness of God. He can judge the way he wants to. And the fact he hasn't judged America, except penultimately, that doesn't mean he's weak and that doesn't mean we're righteous. I mean, after all, we suffered 9/11 and then we had a pandemic and just 2 days ago, Afghanistan fell and America's the laughing stock of the world. People are being killed all over the place because they made friends with the Americans, and there's going to be more terrorism coming out of Afghanistan now, and maybe some more American cities will have buildings drop to the ground. Well, folks, unrighteousness has its rewards. Now, what about the women that are told to be killed by Moses? Well, again, we need to say how sinful these women were. We need to get rid of these old chivalrous ideas that women are the fragile flowers of humanity and they're not ever going to do anything bad. Well, these women deliberately committed adultery and fornication in order to destroy Israel. It started out with just sex, but it ended up with ritual prostitution to join Israelites to Baal Peor, as Glenn Miller says. And this was at a bad time. It was right at the same time that Moses is preparing the Israelites for entrance into the Promised Land and exhorting them to keep the law. Couldn't have been any worse. So let's look more deeply at what these women did for the sake of Balak, the king of Moab's paranoia, and for the sake of the Midianites' anti-Israel sentiment. First of all, they committed wholesale, premeditated, and government-facilitated adultery. This is not just sex. This is adulterous sex. Now, because these are all married women that did this. Now, here are four options as to how the adultery went down. Option number one, the woman could have agreed with Balaam's plan and then talked their husbands into the plan. Hey, honey, would you mind if I seduced the Israelite, get him to worship Baal? And the husband says, no problem, honey, go out and commit adultery. Or option number two, the men agreed with Balaam's plan and then talked their wives into the plan. Hey, wifey, hey, sweetheart, got a great idea. You can go out and seduce somebody. This is adultery we're talking about here. But it could be the men agreed with Balaam's plan and then forced their wives into the plan. Ooh. Forced your wife into prostitution? Well, the problem with that option is that it makes it less just, apparently, for God to kill the women if they were forced into it. So I don't think that's what happened. Or it could be that the chiefs of Midian, the political leaders of Midian, forced both men and women to agree to the plan, in which case the leaders of Midian would be guilty. But again, that lessens the guilt of the women, and the women were wiped out. So I think it's Either the women or their husbands agree to do this, which makes the women adulterers, as well as religious fornicators. Now, let me give you Miller's summation of the crimes of the Midianite women. Quote, "This action slash atrocity by the Midianites is an intensely sordid and depressing tale of greater scale than even that of Sodom and Gomorrah, and of greater anti-Hebrew malice and calculating treachery than even that of the Amalekites. The removal of this exact subculture," that means the Midianites, "without impacting the Moabites, or the rest of the Midianites, the ones down in the south, for good or ill, while mercifully sparing a very large number of innocent young girls," I haven't mentioned this yet, the women who seduced, they were married women, they were killed, but the young girls were left alive so they could marry the Israelite men as slaves. So God, as continuing with the Miller quote, "while mercifully sparing a very large number of innocent young girls, yet without sparing the guilty Israelites, seems neither cruel nor unfair nor unwarranted, given the horrendously dehumanizing character of this crime, and given the unavoidable consequences of conflict upon children in the ancient world." Now, in verse 17, we see that Moses tells the soldiers to kill every woman who has known man intimately. So it's not every woman. It was the married women who had known man intimately. Now, you could say, well, it could be virgin girls who seduced the Israelites. But I don't think so. I don't think virgin girls are going to be out there seducing anybody. This is talking about married women who knew what they were doing. But that leaves alive, according to Moses' command, every woman who had not known man intimately. In other words, the virgins were alive. So here's what happens. The male soldiers are killed. The male little boys were killed. The adult married women were killed. But the unmarried virgin women were kept as captives. They were spared for yourselves, as Moses says. Now, the question might arise, why didn't Moses inquire to see if an individual non-virgin may not have seduced an Israelite? In other words, there were lots of married women who were seducing the Israelites. Well, maybe some of them didn't go along with it. Well, I don't think so. I think all of them probably did, and they all got judged for it. Now, we have another interesting question. How could the Israelites know who was a virgin and who was not a virgin? Well, I just gave the simplest way. If you're married, you're not a virgin. If you're unmarried, you're a virgin. That, to me, is the easiest way. That's the way it was here in the USA before the sexual revolution. But here's some other ideas. You can look at their age. The young girls, they're virgins. John Gill suggests maybe they could be examined by matrons who would look and see if the hymen was broken. I don't think so. Gill also has another great idea. He doesn't necessarily support this, but he's just mentioning these ideas. It could be just by divine revelation. God says, that one's a virgin and that one's not. Oh, come on, please. Glenn Miller suggests is by their dress that virgins, that Midianite virgins would dress differently. I don't know. I think it's just easier to say, go over there. You're married. You get killed. You're single. You're a virgin. You live. Now, the unmarried women who are saved and not killed are said to be spared for yourselves, Moses says. To the Israelites. Spared how? And spared in what capacity? As a wife, I would assume, but John Gill suggests maybe spared as a proselyte. Spared as a household servant? I really don't think so. I think he's talking about wives there. We go down to Numbers 31, verses 19 through 20. "And you camp outside the camp 7 days. Whoever has killed any person and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves, you and your captives, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. You shall purify for yourselves every garment and every article of leather and all the work of goat's hair and all articles of wood." Now, the NIV Study Bible says that since this was a holy war against the Midianites, both people and things had to be cleaned. But I thought after all wars, you had to clean people and things. So I don't know what the NIV Study Bible means there. The idea that you've got to cleanse a person who touches a corpse is found in Numbers 19, 11 through 13. "The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, which is just like we read here in Numbers 31, 3rd day and 7th day. Going back to Numbers 19, verse 12, "Then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. because the water for impurity was not sprinkled in him. He shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. That's just talking about touching a dead body in general, not necessarily in a war. But, of course, in a war, you're going to be touching a lot of dead bodies. So they had to be purified to keep God away from the idea of death, because God is life. The garments were purified. That's not just what the Hebrew soldiers were wearing, but also captive Midianite garments. Goat's hair articles had to be purified. That would be the coverings of tents. All articles of wood had to be purified. And we'll see here in Leviticus 6, 11, and 15, some laws concerning purification of vessels. Let's look at that. Leviticus 6, 28, also the earthenware vessel in which it was boiled shall be broken. And if it was boiled in a bronze vessel, then it shall be scoured and rinsed in water. Now, these scriptures are for the purification of vessels in general, not just necessarily, not having to do with particularly touching a vessel touching a dead body. This is just for purification in general. Here in Leviticus 6:28 is a sin offering. It's boiled in it. Got to make it holy. Break the earthen pot. Rinse the bronze pots. Can't break a bronze vessel, but you can break an earthenware vessel. They were cheap, easy to break, easy to get rid of. Leviticus 11:33, as for any earthenware vessel into which one of them may fall, whatever is in it becomes unclean, and you shall break the vessel. This refers to an earthenware vessel into which an unclean animal fell. You break the vessel. Leviticus 15:12, however, an earthenware vessel which the person with the man, with the discharge, that's a man's discharge, bloody discharge, seminal discharge, any vessel that touches that shall be broken. Every wooden vessel shall be rinsed in water. So you see the principle. You break the earthenware vessels, you wash the other vessels. And also we'll see here later, you burn with fire. At least in our verse here, you burn with fire, or not melt necessarily, but to purify with fire vessels that would become unclean. Now, goat's hair articles, that might refer to the coverings of tents, which were often made with goat's hair. They had to be cleansed too. So lots of cleansing rituals going on after a war. We go now to verse 21, 22, 23, and 24 of Numbers 31. Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to battle, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can stand the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it shall be clean. But it shall be purified with water for impurity." So basically, if you got something hard, metal, you burn it with fire, and then you wash, pour water over it. Fire and water, that cleanses. But whatever cannot stand the fire, you shall pass through the water. That would be like earthenware vessels. And you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean, and afterward you may enter the camp. Verse 21 says that Eleazar is referring to a statute. He says, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded Moses." That's probably Numbers 19:11. "The person who touches any human corpse will be unclean for 7 days. This refers to the purification of those who came into contact with the dead. It does not refer to purification after a war particularly, but it's just in general, you come in contact with the dead, you got to do all this purification. Now, purification is everywhere in the book of Leviticus or in the law, but in particular in the book of Leviticus, the Levites themselves had to get purified. A man with a discharge, Leviticus 15, he had to get purified. A vessel containing a sin offering, Leviticus 6, I just read you that. Lepers had to get purified. Dead insects falling into a bowl. Yeah, we just mentioned all that. So lots of purification. Now, a vessel that touches a dead person had to be passed through the fire. John Gill says that's probably, you passed it through the fire quickly enough so that the metals would not be melted, just purified. Clark says, no, you pass it through the fire for such a long period of time that the metal is melted down. I don't believe that. I think it's just to purify the vessel, not to melt it down or destroy it. Verse 23 talks about purification with water. That should be the water of the ashes of the heifer, the red heifer. Numbers 19:9. Now a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. That means ashes that you put in water. The ashes, of course, symbolizes the purification that's been done by fire. And then water, of course, cleanses you from sin. Good symbolism for washing. The person who touches a dead person is cleansed on the seventh day, as verse 24 says. That's just like the leper in Leviticus 4:10-9. He's cleansed after 7 days. All right, so let's go now to Numbers 31, verses 25 through 31. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "You and Eleazar the priest and the heads of the fathers' households of the congregation take account of the booty that was captured, both of man and of animal, and divide the booty between the warriors who went out to battle and all the congregation. Levy a tax for the Lord from the men of war who went out to battle, one in 500 of the persons and of the cattle and of the donkeys and of the sheep. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as an offering to the Lord. From the sons of Israel's half, you shall take one drawn out of every 50 of the persons of the cattle, of the donkeys, and of the sheep, from all the animals, and give them to the Levites who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord." Moses and Eleazar the priest did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. All right, Eleazar the priest is mentioned here. He's taken over after Aaron has died on Mount Hor, mentioned earlier in Numbers. And he is now the high priest, and I'm sure he represents all the priesthood as he gets the booty. It's not just him personally that he gets his share of the booty. He's going to share it with all the other priests in the priestly order. Now, verse 26 mentions that the congregation should take account of the booty that was captured, both of man and of animal. Well, there's no men left. They all got killed. That just means both of human beings and animals. The contrast is between animals as opposed to humans. Not talking about male as opposed to female, because all those males were gone. Now, they're supposed to divide the booty, it says in verse 27. That means into two equal halves. It doesn't say that, but we can understand that by as we go through this verse here. It's pretty clear from the context. It's two equal halves. This practice of dividing booty taken in war became a standing ordinance later, as John Gill says, for Samuel 30, verse 24. "And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." So the idea behind this idea of sharing booty with the non-combatant soldiers is similar to the practice of World Series winners in baseball. They vote a share to the trainers and the bat boys. That's a lot of people on a baseball team that never get out on the field to play. And those soldiers could never have won the war without the logistical support from the men and women back home in their society. So they share the booty. Now, as far as the priest's share, which is 1/500th of the half of their booty, it says 1 in 500 of the persons and of the cattle and of the donkeys of the sheep. The persons. And so what that means, of course, is that of the virgin women that were not killed, 1 in 500 of them went to the priest. Now, here's what Adam Clark has to say about that. Quote, "Some monsters have supposed that 1 out of every 500 of the captives was offered in sacrifice to the Lord." In other words, 1 out of 500 women, virgin women, were not given to the Israelites as a wife, as wives, but they were offered up on an altar to be killed as a human sacrifice. Adam Clark continues, "But this is abominable. When God chose to have the life of a man, he took it in the way of justice, as in the case of the Midianites above, but never in the way of sacrifice." Of course not. Those are wives. 1 out of every 500 virgin women for a wife for the priest. Now, notice that the soldiers' offering was much less than the congregation's offering. The soldiers only had to offer from their half of the booty 1 in 500 animals of people. But the congregation had to offer from their half of the booty 1 in 50 of the captured booty or people. Well, 1 in 500 is a lot less than 1 in 50, so the soldiers had to offer less. Why? Well, John Gill says, it's because they had risked their lives and entered into the horrors of war. The congregation had not. Note that there were more Levites than priests, and so the congregation had to offer 1 out of 50 to satisfy the donation to the priest, whereas the warriors only had to offer 1 out of 500 to make their offering to the priest, because there's less priests than there are Levites. We go down to Numbers 31, 32 through 40. "Now the booty that remained from the spoil, which the men of war had plundered, was 675,000 sheep and 72,000 cattle and 61,000 donkeys," and on 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 and on. I'm not going to read all that. It's just a list of the sheep, cattle, donkeys, and human beings that were captured in the war. Now, notice this was all one-sided. The other guys didn't capture anything. The Midianites had not done anything against the Israelites. In fact, as Adam Clark points out, reading Numbers 31:49, just a little minute, we'll get there. They said to Moses, "Your servants have taken a census of men of war who are in our charge, and no man of us is missing." So the Israelite soldiers didn't miss a single person. We go now to Numbers 31:41 through 53. Moses gave the levy, which was the Lord's offering, to Eleazar the priest, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. That was the half of the booty that belonged to the soldiers, was given to the priest. Eleazar, who then, I assume, distributed the offering to the rest of the priest. Verse 42, "As for the sons of Israel's half," that's the other half of the booty, which Moses separated from the men who had gone to war, and then that half was listed as 337,500 sheep, I'm not going to read all that. Verse 48, "Then the officers who were over the thousands of the army, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds, approached Moses. And they said to Moses, 'Your servants have taken a census of men of war who are in our charge, and no man of us is missing,' as I just mentioned. 'So we have brought as an offering to the Lord what each man found, articles of gold, omelets and bracelets, signet rings, earrings and necklaces, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord.' Moses and Eleazar took the gold from them, all kinds of wrought articles. All the gold of the offering which they offered up to the Lord, from the captains of thousands to the captains of hundreds, was 16,750 shekels. The men of war had taken booty, every man for himself." Well, let's first talk about the fact that the Israelites had not lost one soldier in this war. This is what John Gill says about this. Quote, "This is a most amazing and unheard of thing, that in waging war with a whole nation, slaying all their males, sacking and burning so many cities, plundering the inhabitants of their substance, taking and carrying off such a vast number of captives, yet not one should fall by the sword of the enemy or by any disease or accident, whatever, but all to a man should return to the camp of Israel again. This is not to be paralleled in any history." Here's what Adam Clark says about it. Quote, "That not one man should have been slain is a most extraordinary circumstance, and powerfully marks the peculiar superintendence of God's especial providence. The Midianites must certainly have made some resistance, but that was ineffectual, because it was against the Lord. When any nation undertakes a crusade against those whom they are pleased to call the Lord's enemies, let them bring from the contest this proof of their divine mission, viz., that not one man of them is either lost or missing, and then, not till then, shall we believe that God has sent them." Jameson Farson Brown said this, quote, "This was a victory so signal, and the glory of which was untarnished by the loss of a single Israelite soldier, was an astonishing miracle." Now, in verse 50, the soldiers gave a bunch of gold articles that they had captured for atonement. Now, this is, I'm sure, from their... This is in addition to the 1 out of 50 that they'd already given, 1 out of 500 that they'd already given to the priest. This is out of their share. They're given some gold jewelry to make atonement for themselves. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's not merely a thank offering, because it says atonement. Thank offerings weren't for atonement. Here's some options as to what was being atoned for. The atonement is like a sin offering. Atonement covers your sin. Well, was it the battle itself, because they fought the battle? Of course not. It was the Lord's war. It belonged to Yahweh. It was a holy war. No, that's not it. Was it to make atonement for any sin that they might have committed in the execution of the war, as John Gill suggests? Well, it could be. Wars are bloody, nasty business, and people can sometimes violate the rules of war, as they often do. Could it be that they want to make atonement for sparing the women that they should have put to death? According to John Gill, could be. This is my idea. It could be they just wanted atonement for their sinful condition, which they were all generally born with. Yeah, we fought a war, but we're sinners anyway. We want to make atonement. Maybe the war brought them close to their mortality, made them start thinking about ultimate things. I don't know. Maybe it was because they didn't put their individual booty into the common pile that was divided. The reason I say that might be it, because we look at the last verse, verse 53, the men of war had taken booty, every man for himself, and that could mean they kept some stuff out of the common pile that was divided in half between the congregation and between the soldiers. Maybe they individually took some stuff that they shouldn't have done. That's what it sounds like to me. Adam Clark says, it sounds like the men did not contribute their individually taken booty with all the rest, not following the rules. Ladies and gentlemen, the booty of the Midianites has been divided. We are now finished with chapter 31, and we are now prepared in our next audio to go to chapter 32, verses 1 through 42. We will see the distribution of the land to Reuben and Gad in Gilead on the east side of the Jordan River. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.